Chapter 13, Evangeline, May 24, 1923. Evangeline slept on dreamlessly, despite the chatter of birds in the ivy outside her window and the morning sun shining in her face. She slept through the clattering of breakfast dishes and the sound of Danny whistling in the backyard. Only the sound of someone tapping gently and persistently on her door finally woke her. She rolled over onto her back and took her bearings. It was the day. The day. The tapping persisted, discreet but insistent. She smiled. Joshua. It must be. He had read her letter and, not wanting to disturb her sleep, had waited until morning to tell her that she wouldn't have to do it. The thundering falls and the hungry rocks were no longer part of her future. There was only Joshua McLaren and time. Plenty of time. To learn to love each other. She sat up, finger-combed her hair, and said, "Come in." It wasn't Joshua who came in, it was Frank, looking pathetically young and pathetically worried. His hair was uncombed, his clothes were rumpled, and his eyes were swollen, as though he'd been crying. Evangeline hadn't seen her son look this way in years, not since the days when he would come home from yet another new school to tell her that he was being beaten up by bigger boys and that Jeremy would do nothing to stop them. "Mother," he cried dramatically, and collapsed onto his knees at the side of the bed, burying his head in her lap. She stroked the top of his dark head, wishing it was Joshua with his head in her lap and Joshua's thick red hair under her fingers. She put such thoughts aside and concentrated on her young son. "Come on, Frank," she said. "It can't be all that bad." That was what she'd always said. "Yes, it is," he said, his voice muffled by the bedclothes. "Dad's gone, and Jeremy's gone, and by this afternoon you'll be gone. And anyway, you hate me, I know you do." She pulled him up by his hair and looked into his face. "I don't hate you," she said. "I'd like to, but I can't." "Now what do you mean? Where have they gone?" "I don't know. At least I know where Jeremy's gone, but I don't know where Dad is." She really did not want to ask the next question. But she knew that Frank would find it strange if she didn't even ask. "Where do you think he is?" she asked.
"I don't know," he wailed.
He sat slumped on the side of the bed, his head down, eyes averted. "We were supposed to meet Dad last night, midnight, outside Miss Lily's. She won't let him inside, you know." "I know," said Evangeline. "Something about him winning too regularly." "I sympathize with the woman. Go on, Frankie."
"He never came," Frankie wailed. "So we went looking for him, but he's nowhere to be found. We went to his hotel, but the clerk said that Dad had sent someone for his bags and checked out."
Evangeline felt as though her heart was made of stone. Frank was brokenhearted, worrying about his father, but his worry and his heartbreak were having no effect on her. She could only feel admiration for Iris, who had apparently taken care of all the details. She looked at her tearful son and realized that she would never be able to tell him the truth. The secret was not hers alone. It belonged to Iris now, and Iris was the one at risk. "I expect someone gave him money," she said, "and he's run out on you."
"You mean Mr. McLaren?" Frank said.
"No," said Evangeline. "I'm sure that Mr. McLaren would not have given him money."
"He was going to ask him for $10,000," Frank said, "and we were going to share it."
Evangeline lifted her son's chin, none too gently, and looked him in the eye. "And you don't see anything wrong with that?" she asked.
"Me and Jeremy, we talked about it," Frank said, "and we thought he wouldn't settle for just $10,000, so that's why we're surprised he left. We thought he'd wait around to see if you, well, you know, if you survived," said Evangeline.
Frank nodded.
"He'd have waited to find out unless he got some money from somewhere else. He hinted about getting even more money from someone. I don't know who it was, but he said it was a rich person."
Evangeline patted him on the top of his head. "Think no more of it, Frank. Obviously, he got his money, and he's gone. You shouldn't have any illusions about your father, Frank. He'd sell his own mother if the price was right."
"I know he's been pretty rotten to you," Frank said, "but he's always been pretty straight with me and Jeremy. Even when he was supposed to be, you know, dead, he'd still turn up every now and then with a few dollars in his pocket and a scheme to get more."
"How kind of him," said Evangeline. "I had no idea that he was teaching you two how to be criminals.
while I was trying to teach you how to be gentlemen. Jeremy's quite sure that something's happened to him, Frank said. I wouldn't be surprised, Evangeline said, knowing that she was coming too near the truth but longing to tell Frank the whole truth about his father.
I mean something really bad, Frank persisted. Jeremy thinks he could have been shot and killed.
Evangeline drew in a deep breath to steady her voice.
Why would he think that?
He has enemies everywhere, Frank said. Maybe somebody found him.
I suppose it's possible, Evangeline said.
Jeremy thinks it's probably old man McLaren. I mean, Dad asked him for money, and maybe McLaren shot him instead. He's old, but he's pretty tough, and he's been a soldier, so he's used to killing people.
He could have killed Dad.
No, said Evangeline vehemently. That's not the kind of thing Mr. McLaren would do. Put that idea right out of your head and don't go repeating that to anyone.
I don't think it's him, Frank said. I think it's those two ladies, Miss Braithwaite and Miss DeVere. I think Dad was tapping them for money as well. I could just imagine Miss Braithwaite gunning someone down. She doesn't like any men at all. I bet she wouldn't think twice about shooting one.
I'm sure that no one has shot him, Evangeline said. He's just gone away, Frankie, and left you to your fate.
Jeremy thinks that whoever got Dad will get us next, Frank said. We were up all night worrying about it, and Jeremy got the first train out this morning. He said he wasn't staying here to be killed.
Despite everything, Evangeline felt an overwhelming sadness to think that her handsome son had left in fear, and that he would probably be running in fear for the rest of his life.
And what about you? Evangeline asked. She climbed out of the bed. Hand me my robe, will you?
Why didn't you go with him?
Frankie, fully clothed, boots and all, climbed into the warm bed that Evangeline had just vacated and pulled the covers up to his chin.
I'm so cold, he said. We've been out all night wandering around. We don't know what to do.
Oh, Frankie, said Evangeline, looking despairingly at her son.
This morning Jeremy caught the first train out. I had a ticket, Frank said, but at the last minute I changed my mind.
Evangeline turned, hairbrush in hand.
Why? She asked.
Frank snuggled further into the bed.
I couldn't leave you to do this on your own, he said. I know I haven't been very good to you, Mother, but I do love you.
Evangeline finally managed to smile. Did you really tell Jeremy that you wouldn't go with him?
You always go with him.
Tell me the truth. Did he just go and leave you behind?
No, said Frank firmly. I decided all on my own to stay here with you. You need someone to look after you. I'm going to take care of you.
Evangeline smiled.
Sure you are, she said.
Privately, she thanked her lucky stars that it was Joshua who was going to take care of her and not Frank. Perhaps Frank and Danny could be friends, maybe work together at the boatyard. She realized that she was fantasizing an entire future on the basis of one note she had written and a single gunshot that she had heard in the night.
Frank closed his eyes. Just let me sleep for a few minutes, he said, and then I'll be wide awake and ready to help you. Just a few minutes. But don't forget to wake me up. I want to come with you.
Evangeline dropped a kiss on the top of his head and left the room, closing the door gently behind her. They were all in the kitchen. Nell, Cornelia, Iris, and Danny, fully dressed and waiting. The wireless was chattering in the background. An excited reporter was giving the latest news from Niagara Falls. Evangeline listened for a moment and heard that the weather was expected to be clear, but cool. She heard that she might be rather chilly in her notoriously brief bathing suit. The reporter wondered if she might want to take a blanket into the barrel with her. She also heard that the river was running fast and deep this morning, fed by the melting of the ice pack on Lake Erie.
The deeper the better, said Danny. You don't want to get hung up on the rim.
Evangeline nodded and helped herself calmly to a cup of coffee.
The reporter continued with a description of the waiting crowds.
3 hours to launch time, and already the bleachers were crowded and sightseers were lining the sidewalks.
How disappointed they were going to be, Evangeline thought, when they learned that she wasn't going to do it.
Do you want to eat anything at all? Nell asked solicitously. She had on a new dress, a red one, and silk stockings. With her new haircut, she looked quite stylish and attractive, nothing like the woman that Evangeline had met months before.
She also had a kind of secretive smile hovering around her lips, as if something good had happened. But she wasn't about to share it.
Oatmeal, said Evangeline. A nice big bowl of oatmeal.
I'm not so sure you should, Cornelia said.
Wouldn't you rather keep an empty stomach? It would look pretty dreadful if you puked all over the barrel.
But I'm not going in the barrel, Evangeline said to herself.
Oh, really, Cornelia, Iris said. Let her eat whatever she wants.
How are you feeling, Evangeline?
Just fine, said Evangeline. Did you sleep? Iris asked. I wondered if you had any last-minute visitors or anything like that.
I did some writing, Evangeline said.
Iris raised her eyebrows inquiringly.
I thought it would be good to send a note to Mr. McLaren, just to be sure that everything was clearly understood.
Would you want me to deliver it? Iris asked.
Oh, no, I already made arrangements, Evangeline replied. But thank you for offering, and for all the other help you've given me.
Nell set a bowl of oatmeal in front of Evangeline. I hope it was all right to send your son upstairs, she said. He looked very upset.
He's fine, said Evangeline. He's asleep, in my bed.
He was probably worried about you, Nell said. He looked as though he hadn't slept a wink last night.
I know I didn't.
Where's your brother? Evangeline asked as casually as she could. Is he not having breakfast?
Oh, he's still guarding his boat, I suppose, said Cornelia. We haven't seen hide nor hair of the man this morning.
Has he sent you an answer? Asked Iris.
Answer to what? Cornelia asked. Why would he be sending her answers?
I went out to see him early this morning, Danny said, and took him a flask of tea.
Did he give you a message? Iris and Evangeline asked, almost in concert.
Danny looked from one to the other of the anxious ladies.
No, he said, no message. He just said that he expected everything to go as planned.
No message, Iris repeated.
Did you give the message to Maddie? Nell asked.
Yes, I asked him to take it for me, Evangeline confirmed.
I saw him last night, Nell said, and she seemed to be blushing. He was on his way to deliver your note, but I should tell you.
Do you think he forgot? Evangeline asked.
No, he wouldn't forget, Nell said, but there might be a problem because...
He didn't answer me, Evangeline interrupted her. Her heart dropped like a stone and confidence turning to panic. He didn't even think it was worth an answer.
Oh, God, I have to do this. I really have to do this. I'm sorry, I have to go and lie down for a minute. I think I'm going to be sick.
It's just nerves, Cornelia said. Remember the cause, over the falls for freedom.
Fame, Evangeline said.
Fame and fortune. That's what I wanted and that's what I still want. Forget everything else. Forget about the message. It doesn't matter now. None of it matters. There's only one thing left for me to do, and I'm going to do it. Call me when it's time to leave. I'm going to put my bathing suit on.
Joshua. Joshua was grateful that Danny had come to wake him at the crack of dawn. Without Danny's intervention, he would have gone on dreaming. As it was, the dreams had left him exhausted. He had woken to find that he had rolled out of his blanket, and there was a chill in his bones which could not be dissipated by the tea that Danny had brought him. He huddled under the harsh woolen blanket and watched the morning mist roll off the river. His bones always ached when he woke. Somewhere deep in their marrow they carried a memory of knee-deep mud and soaking rain. Even the moments of glory had done nothing to ease the ache. 4 years of misery and the loss of his son and his brother was too high a price to pay for the quick thrill of finally going over the top at Vimy Ridge and seeing the enemy in full flight. And now morning had come. The river was still there. The falls still thundered, and Evangeline was still beyond his reach and beyond his ability to keep safe. A woman who could not give up her quest for fame. There was little for him to do for the next 3 hours. He would, of course, check that the barrel had been safely delivered to the launch point and that Teddy Hillsgrove understood the signal he was to give to his father. The boy was intelligent enough, Joshua thought, much more intelligent than his father. There was nothing complicated anyway. Teddy had only to read the rangefinder and wave a red flag when the launch boat had reached the release point. Below the falls, the rescue boat waited on the beach, engine primed and oars stowed as a backup. Joshua had thrown in a couple of cork life preservers as an afterthought, one for Danny and one for himself. He stood up, stretched his arms, and then bent to touch his toes, trying to straighten out his spine. While he was still bent over, he was hailed from the cliff path, and he looked up to see the red coat of Sergeant Renfrew. He waited until the Mountie had reached the bottom of the steps before he said, "You've no need to worry, we have our permits. Go see the Braithwaite woman."
Renfrew came on across the beach.
"I don't doubt you," he said. "I couldn't imagine the town hall giving that woman any trouble."
"Have you seen the people up on the street this morning, Josh? The town must be raking in money hand over fist."
"It's an ill wind," Joshua said.
"You're right about that."
"Tea?" Joshua asked, offering the flask.
"Don't mind if I do." The policeman unscrewed the lid of the thermos and poured tea into the metal cup.
"So," said Joshua, "if it's not the permits, what is it? Or are you just being sociable?"
Renfrew shook his head.
"Afraid not," he said. "Official business."
"Oh, yes?"
"A freighter out of Detroit picked up a body last night, just off East Island."
"So?"
"Seems the fellow had been murdered. He had a nice, neat little bullet hole in his chest."
"Sorry to hear that," Joshua said. "I suppose that's going to be keeping you busy."
He knew he was maintaining an outside calm, but inwardly he was uneasy. He had waited for John Murray last night until well after 10 o'clock, and there had been no sign of him. Had someone else reached him first?
Joshua thought of the $10,000 he had stashed away behind a crate in the boat shed. He knew he would have given it to the man if he'd turned up.
"Well-dressed fellow," said Renfrew, "or that's what I hear. He hadn't been in the water long."
"What exactly does this have to do with me?" Joshua asked.
Renfrew didn't answer him. Instead, he looked up and said,
"Well, look who's up and about this morning."
Matty Ferguson was making his way towards them across the beach, looking a little cleaner and brighter than usual.
"Morning, Josh," he grunted. "Sergeant, I got something for you, Josh."
"Oh, yes? Meant to give it to you last night, but I clean forgot. Sorry about that."
Matty reached inside his jacket and then looked at the police officer.
"I'll give it to you in a minute. Why do you have the police here?"
"They found a body off East Island," Joshua said.
"Probably came from here," Matty said.
"No, I don't think so," Joshua said carefully. "We were thinking the same thing," Renfrew said, "that the body must have been carried down the river from around here somewhere."
"No," Joshua said firmly, "not from here."
"Well," said Renfrew, "there's no point in me running around this morning asking about missing people if it didn't come out of here at all. That's why I came to see you. Do you realize how many people there are in town right now, and how many of them would be candidates for a bullet in the chest? I could be checking names for the next 6 weeks."
"A floater?" Matty asked. "And pretty new?"
"That's right," said Renfrew.
"Then he's bound to have come out of here. No two ways about it," Matty said.
Joshua shook his head. "You're talking through the back of your neck, Matty. You haven't been able to think straight since Flanders. So don't you go trying to mislead the police. It did not come from here."
"Hey, now, wait a minute," Matty said.
Joshua knew he had offended Matty deeply, but it was the only way to keep him quiet.
"Look, Renfrew," he said to the Mountie, "he didn't come from here. There was a strong wind last night, don't forget that. He couldn't have come from here, not with the wind blowing out of the west like that."
"Wind don't make no difference," Matty argued.
"Don't be more of a fool than you can help," Joshua snapped at him. "Wind makes all the difference. The way the weather was last night, he could have come out of Hamilton or St. Catharines, not here."
Renfrew nodded his head. "I'll tell them up at HQ. They'll take your word for it, Josh. There's no one knows this river better than you do. I can't say I'm sorry to hear he's not one of ours. I've plenty of better things to do with my time today. Thanks for the tea." He handed the flask back to Joshua. "I'm off now," he said. "We've got our work cut out controlling the crowds." He turned to Matty Ferguson. "You coming with me?" he asked. "I'm going to lock the gate when I get to the top. Don't want a lot of strangers wandering around down here."
Matty glared at Joshua. "I was going to stay and help old Josh, but I've changed my mind. I'm sure Josh doesn't want to keep company with an old fool who apparently knows nothing about anything, especially nothing about the currents around here. I'll come up with you, Sarge."
He coughed a couple of times and then looked at Joshua again. "Ain't like you to make fun of a man," he said. "It weren't my fault I got gassed."
"Matty," Joshua said, "I didn't mean—"
"Of course you did," Matty said. "I know that's what everyone thinks. Why did Matty Ferguson live when all those McLarens died? I guess there's no justice."
"You said you had something for him," Redfrew said. "Give him whatever it is and let's get going."
"Oh, yes, I have something for you to read," Matty said.
"Read?" Joshua tried to keep his face impassive.
"I... something for you to read," Matty repeated, holding out a small white envelope.
Damn, Joshua thought, what do I do now with both of them watching me?
He took the envelope and opened it. There was paper inside, covered with many lines of spidery writing in turquoise ink. Very pretty and totally incomprehensible.
Well, I'll be on my way, Maddie said, unless you want to write an answer.
Joshua scanned the letter, trying to make believe that the writing had meaning for him.
No, he said, after what seemed an appropriate interval. It's nothing important at all.
He folded the letter and put it in the back pocket of his pants.
Sergeant Renfrew extended his hand formally to Joshua.
I'll be busy from now on, he said, so I won't get another chance to speak to you.
I wish you success, Josh.
Don't get yourself drowned over this fool stunt.
I won't, said Joshua.
They left him alone on the beach, and Joshua breathed a sigh of relief.
Maddie was right, of course. The body had come out of the mouth of the Niagara and had been carried on the westerly waves.
John Murray?
It was possible.
Nothing but a bullet would come between that man and $10,000.
But who?
He decided not to speculate.
Not yet.
He pulled the note from his back pocket.
Who had sent it?
He searched for a clue. There was something feminine about the color of the ink, and the signature was a name that began with an easily deciphered E.
Evangeline.
Was it from her?
It must surely be.
Had she changed her mind? Had she forgiven him for acting like a self-righteous prig? Did she want to make her peace with him before she took her last dangerous voyage?
He traced the script with a thick forefinger, mouthing the letters, but it was no use.
Try as he might, he could find no sense in the turquoise scribbling. He replaced the note in his back pocket.
If Evangeline had anything important to say, surely she would have said it in person.